was relapsums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 151 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. In Somerville, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from San Francisco, California, is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
Oh, I'm good.
Have you had any six-figure scores recently?
Yes, since last time we recorded.
Well, that's good to hear. What a good time for me to ask. So anything you'd like to say about that?
I mean, there's plenty we can talk about in regard to this. So for people who haven't heard, who aren't following me on Twitter or looking at the blog, and I would forgive you, by the way, if you've have not spent much time checking the blog, because I know I haven't been posting a lot more than podcasts recently. But there is some good strategy content on there right now, I think. I won this tournament at Lucky Chances. I think it's their kind of biggest annual event. It's definitely one of like two or three biggest, but I think it might be even the only $1,000 tournament they have all year. But they have a 1K that's kind of runs on the weekend before Thanksgiving. So we're recording this now the Monday after Thanksgiving. I won the tournament. Or no, we're recording this Saturday after Thanksgiving. I won the tournament on the Monday before Thanksgiving. That was the final day. So it's a... it's a two-day tournament with 2 day ones. So I played day 1A on Saturday, scrubbed out, almost didn't re-enter, honestly, partly because I was sort of sick. If my voice still sounds a little funny, that's the reason. So I almost didn't re-enter on Sunday just because, like, 10-handed tournament poker is so boring. It's just, like, almost, I mean, I don't want to say miserable because... It trivializes true misery, but you know, I was not having a good time sitting around playing like short stack 10-handed poker. For some reason, the antes were really small too, so a lot of times the ante was like 1/8 of a big blind. One-eighth of a small blind. Yes, there's only the antes of 1/8 of a small blind, like half what they would ordinarily be in a, or what I'm used to them being in like a WSOP type structure. So all of that just kind of made the game not terribly interesting, but it was also extremely profitable. I mean, this pretty much everybody playing, it was just kind of like a lot of people who are regulars at Lucky Chances who often are playing like 1-1-2 or maybe 3-5 or just like random daily tournaments that they have at Lucky Chances. And this was kind of their like one big thing a year. Either they want a satellite in or they just, you know, put up the $1,000, but it was kind of a splurge for them, you know. So there were just a lot of people who really didn't have a lot. I mean, they just weren't top-notch poker players. And then on top of that, they were like really risk averse in this particular tournament because this was like a big thing for them. And I think many of them didn't have a lot of tournament experience or like only had live tournament experience. And you kind of know how these little like ecosystems go where people just sort of pass around a lot of wrong information among themselves and like confirm and entrench each other's bad habits, which I mean, live poker is like that. I mean, it's you don't really get enough volume to learn from experience of playing exclusively live poker. So it seemed like too good of an opportunity to not re-enter day two. And I thought, because you know, Neil Blumenfeld, who we had on the show somewhat recently, who got third in the main event of the World Series of Poker and who we are hoping to bring back on the show eventually, although he's playing a lot of poker now, so it's kind of hard to get a hold of him. But so I thought he might be there. He wasn't there on Saturday. I thought he might be there on Sunday, so I re-entered on Sunday. Neil was not there, but I did make it through Sunday and ultimately win the tournament, which was a nice consolation prize for not getting to meet Neil Blumenfeld.
Yeah, I think you owe him a beer.
I think I do.
Well, very nice, very nice. Well, congratulations. I know I've said that to you in a variety of ways, but well done. And and I do want to say your blog posts are quite good for people who like the Thinking Poker Diaries. It's a bit like a free version of that. So I mean, shorter, but yeah, it's really I really enjoyed reading your write ups, even though some of it was stuff I already knew from Twitter or from talking to you.
Thanks.
And can I also give Neil a shout out real quick here? I have a little bit of Neil Blumenfeld commentary.
It might be Field, actually. I might have been saying it wrong.
Yeah. Anyway. So he's getting some flack for how he busted in third place. You know, somebody raised, and then the button 3-bet. Joe 3-bet the button, and then he 4-bet with not much fold equity with deuces all in a ICM spot that's a little bit debatable. And, like, he's getting a lot of flack for that. And I think it's a little bit inappropriate in two ways. Number one, I thought he played extremely well the rest of the final table. And how he busted is overshadowing that a little bit. And second is that Neil would be the first to tell you, I think, that he's not somebody who's played 10 million hands of poker and run all the computer simulations from scratch and so on. So, excuse me. I mean, I think that play is pretty clearly a mistake. It's not the right play to make, but I think all the ingredients that he had were right. So, like, he was right that deuces plays hot and cold, okay-ish. He was right to generally be aggressive and to understand in general that he probably needed to have his foot on the gas pedal. And and I think the spot, you know, when I think he was also right to think that Joe would be 3-betting a cutoff open there pretty often, just because it seems like a good thing to do. All that said, you know, I think those things don't add up to a shove with deuces there. I think the play is poor, but I think it's a failure that's kind of to be expected from the sort of player Neil is. And, like, he was so good at exercising his strengths, and I think he had a lot of the ingredients of the situation right, and I think it's probably not fair to, like, come down on him too hard for how he busted. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that all sounds reasonable. That's actually the only hand I'm familiar with. I haven't watched the final table coverage. My understanding is that the play was so slow. It's just I don't often enjoy watching televised poker that much. I mean, the final table of the main event is could be an exception to that, but it just everything I've heard didn't really make it sound like I was missing out on that much, not having seen it, to be honest.
No, I mean, if you're a Neil Blumenfeld fan, then you were, but still, yeah, you can always catch the edited stuff. I thought he was choosing some bluffing spots well. I thought he was, like, not slow playing in spots when slow playing would have been bad. I just thought he took a good approach into the final table, and I think getting all the way to third reflects that. So, and he was the podcast choice. He came on the show, not just saying all this because he came on the show, but I was rooting for him. You know, the official Thinking Poker representative at the final table. So congratulations to Neil.
Yeah, and, you know, I told him this in an email as well, but I think and I'm curious to ask him, you know, whether this feels like a victory, because we did ask him how he would feel if he got ninth place, and he said he would not be happy. and he came in third in chips, and he ended up finishing third. And so I don't know, you know, how he feels about that, whether he feels like I didn't improve any, or, you know, it's not really a victory because I just got, you know, like the place that I was in when I showed up or something. But I think given that he was one of the less experienced poker players at the table, in the minority as a non-professional player, I think that coming out in the same place where he came in, I think that really can be considered a victory. Like, I don't think that's a given at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy for people to either just kind of crack under the pressure, or just, like, you know, all kind of things can go wrong. It's not like I don't need to tell people this. You're not guaranteed to get whatever place you come in at. So, yeah, I think it's a real accomplishment that he was able to hold on to that third place against a very tough field.
Yeah, I also want to know what he said in other interviews, because, like, hearing him say that, how, like, he really wouldn't be happy if he got ninth, etc., I was, you know, it sounded very sincere, but it's hard not to think there was an element of a pump fake there, because he says that and you're like, okay, for reasonable reasons, this person wants to collect a couple million dollars by laddering. And then he comes in and he's like 4-bet bluffing. He's doing all these things. like that was not, he didn't look the least bit scared. So I wonder if there was an element of smoke to what he said on air.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully we get a chance to ask him all those things.
Yeah. And speaking of Nick Cast Nation, Carlos is now, like, an official partner or something stream on Twitch, and the stream is great. So if you're into poker on Twitch, and if for some reason you're not checking out Carlos, that's something you can check out. And also, you know, we're happy for him for that. I think the twitching thing is going well for him. So hooray for Carlos.
Yeah, Well, just hooray for Carlos in general, Twitch or not. Hooray for Carlos.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's really crushing it. That's
So I wanted to ask you one, actually, a situation that arose after the tournament was over. And I think overall, we've talked about tipping on the show before, and I really want to try to keep this somewhat specific to this particular incident. You know, I know people have different opinions on whether you should tip and how much you should tip and all that sort of thing. And I'll just kind of say briefly, in this situation, there was no doubt that I was going to tip. I mean, one thing is, like, I'm a regular in this room. I know a lot of the dealers just from a kind of purely quality of life standpoint. Even if I didn't think that they, like, deserved it, it would be pretty ill-advised for me not to give a tip, I think. I think my future play at this casino would be pretty miserable,
yeah,
if I did not give a tip of some sort. That's not the main reason that I did it. I think that, you know, legitimately the people deserved it. I think the amount of rake that was taken was reasonable. It was 1,000 plus 80, and they didn't withhold any of 1,000 for anything else.
Okay.
So it was, you know, 8% was taken out for expenses and whatnot, but I didn't mind giving another 1% or so of my winnings on top of that. That seemed reasonable to me. So I was fully intending to leave a tip, and when you finish, there's all this paperwork and stuff that they have to do, and they don't do this as often as the people like the World Series of Poker do, and they don't have the World Series of Poker has a very streamlined process for doing all these cash outs, because they have to do, you know, hundreds of them or thousands of them a day. But we're taking a while, we're doing this paperwork, and they're writing things up, and they asked me how many times I entered, because they're going to deduct my number of entries after they verify them from my prize and to determine how much gets reported to the IRS on my W-2G. And I told them at that time that I was going to leave a $1,000 tip. And they did not deduct that from the W-2G, which my recollection is that is how the World Series of Poker does it. Like, whatever you leave for a tip doesn't show up on your tax form and is not reported. So they didn't deduct that. When I saw that, I asked them about it, and they said that that's not something that they do. So then I said, well, can you give me, like, some sort of receipt or something? And this isn't that big of a deal, because obviously I don't have receipts for a lot of my losses in the poker room. So to some extent, it's just a matter of, like, you know, I'm documenting this stuff contemporaneously in the way that I understand I'm supposed to. And I guess just like any of my other losses, this is sort of it could just be considered another loss that's not verified with a paper trail, but it didn't seem unreasonable to me to want to get some sort of receipt. And they were a little, like, standoffish about that, which I didn't like. And then told me that there wasn't anyone there who could give me a receipt right then. And I was like, well, the next time I'll be here, it's Friday. Would someone on Friday be able to give me a receipt? And they kind of told me, yes, asked for a ship supervisor, a shift supervisor, that sort of thing. So right now it's Monday, 2 a.m. I've just won the tournament. They're telling me if I give them a receipt now, I can't get a receipt. Or if I give them the tip now, I can't get a receipt. If I wait until Friday to bring them the tip, I can get a receipt. What's your play?
So the first thing I think is that I don't know much about tipping and the tax consequences of that. I generally just in cash games tip out of my stack, and then it just sort of gets absorbed into my wins or losses. And then I record it. So I hope that's okay. I'm not sure if it is. If anybody from the IRS is listening, that's how I do it. Sorry. I'm trying my best here. So that said, like, I'm not actually sure what the tax status of tips are and whether those just count as losses. It makes sense that they would, but that's a subject that I'm not an expert on. Second, I agree that it's probably not a big deal, even if you don't get a receipt for it, just because a lot of this depends on contemporaneous record keeping, and if you make a good faith effort to do things properly, that's going to be very good, I think, and you are, in fact, planning on being honest about it, and, you know, if worst comes to worst, you can point the IRS to this very podcast episode if you get any questions about it. And for some of the same diplomatic reasons that for diplomatic reasons also, I wouldn't want to, like, delay the tip. So I would probably just give a tip at the time and maybe, like, take a picture of it with my cell phone as I was doing that, and then talk to a shift supervisor later and ask politely and push a little bit, but not too hard. And if I don't get a receipt, that's okay. But I do see why you would want one. And so I think, you know, in the very worst case, I mean, not that you want to lose, you know, 30% of it or whatever, and not that you will, but I think for a lot of reasons, you don't want to push the issue too much, and it depends on matters of fact that I don't really know. But I think you're handling it well so far.
Yeah, so part of it was a bit of part of it was just poor judgment, because I've been playing, you know, poker for a sure. long time, and was sort of sick and just kind of running high on like adrenaline and caffeine and cough medicine and whatnot, and now it was like 2 a.m. and whatever. But so I just kind of had this like, especially because I was getting a little bit of like attitude about it, I just like really dug in my heels on
that. If they're giving you attitude about leaving a table, whoa.
It wasn't quite that. It was just like, I don't know, like they were acting like I was being kind of unreasonable or like not making much effort to like accommodate, or just kind of like, I don't know, I've never heard of anything like that. Are you leaving a tip or not? Just like a little like that.
Okay, well, in that case, then like the amount of giving them a, like then like withholding a tip for 3 days, like, so A, everybody understands that there are logistics around this and it's actually not a big deal to come back later and tip, I think. So then I think you're fine.
Well, so the thing is, like, that's also a thing people do when they're not going to tip. It's like, oh, I'll get you on Friday.
Yeah.
So I can understand, like, I think I have a good enough reputation around the room that, like, I don't think I strike people as the sort of person who's going to, like, say I'm going to tip and then not do it or something. So I think that helps a lot, that I have some credibility there. But I think there definitely were some like rumors floating around the poker. So I did leave a tip Friday night, last night, by the way. So that has been taken care of now, and hopefully that'll squelch things. And I did talk to a few floor people I know and kind of explain the situation to them and ask them nicely if they would do what they could to squash any rumors about my stiffing. But I still think for all the reasons you said, I think it's not that likely to become an issue, and it's the magnitude of it. If you figure there's like a 2% chance of this becoming an issue, and if it is an issue, it costs, you know, $300 or $400, then, you know, it's costing me something like $5 to leave the tip immediately rather than wait for that's my expected value of waiting for a receipt is something like $5, and it's probably not worth the hassle that comes along with it. The other issue that may have evolved, the people were a little vague about this when I gave the tip yesterday, is that, and this would be shitty if it happens, but I feel like it's really more on them and than on me, is that the people getting the tips now might actually be different. Like, I guess the way they distribute them is on a weekly basis. So it's going to like go into this week's tip pool rather than last week's tip pool.
Yeah.
Which it makes sense. And if they had told me that at the time, it might have been enough to like sway my decision. But I mean, ultimately, I feel like it wasn't unreasonable for me to ask. It turns out there was actually someone there who could have given me a receipt, and he just didn't know it. But he was the same person who ultimately gave me the receipt on Friday. He was like, "Oh yeah, it turns out I could have done that, but I didn't know I could do it at the time." So, like, I feel like it's kind of on them. Like, I don't think it was an unreasonable request on my part, and it probably wouldn't be impossible for them to go back and give the tip to the right people if they really wanted to. So if they end up not doing it, like, I'm sorry. And if I had known that was going to be the issue, I probably would have tried to work around it. But at this point, like, I feel like it's more an issue of poor processes on Lucky Chance's part than it is mine. There was one case where I knew there was a floor person who was in a position to possibly get screwed by this, and I gave him some additional cash out of pocket. But that's kind of the way it seems to have, or it may be shaking out at the moment.
Yeah, that seems fine. I think probably everybody's going to come out okay. If you happen to know of a dealer who had a couple downs worth of tip not get to him, like, I might try to get him a beer or something, toss him a red chip the next time you win a pot with him dealing or her dealing. But I think you're handling this okay. I think I think everybody understands that, you know, you're going to behave properly and generously, but you're also going to, you know, look out for your interests as you should. And I think that's fine. One reason this is something I know nothing about is that a good majority of my live tournament caches ever are at the World Series, where they take out money for the dealers. That is a good percentage, I think. So I don't tip on top of that. So, my whole World Series experience with this is people asking if I want a tip and me saying no. So that's that. Not that the dealers get paid the way they should, but money coming out of the prize pool is not the problem, I think.
Yeah. So a couple other little things that are sort of like the aftermath of winning the tournament. And again, I'll direct people, if you're interested in hearing about like hands from the tournament or kind of a rundown from it, it's completely free, thinkingpoker.net. I've got Battle of the Bay, day one and day two, both on there. And you can read about everything from the very beginning of the tournament all the way up through the final table. I'll probably be posting some hands from the tournament on the blog. So if you're interested in hearing details about the actual tournament rather than tax implications of tipping, if that happens to be of more interest to you, look on the blog, thinkingpoker.net. So, you know, this is a pretty high profile event within this particular casino. So the final table, even before the final table, there's like a fair number of people standing around watching, and particularly the final table, there was a crowd of maybe 50 to 60 people just kind of like watching the whole thing go down. And this might be another like sort of ill-advised, but you'll probably understand why I chose to do this. And I was hoping it would like at least be a little bit of a joke, but it didn't get very many laughs. After I won, I think it didn't help that I hadn't been interacting with the crowd at all, like since not that there was a lot of opportunity for it, but so after I won, I turned to the crowd and I said, I'll be getting a check, by the way, just so nobody gets any ideas in the parking lot. Somebody told me he thought that was tacky.
It's, I mean,
didn't seem wildly unreasonable.
No, it's funny. Yeah, it's yeah.
It wasn't entirely a joke.
Yeah, no. I wouldn't
actually something I want them to know. Just like there's a bunch of people who are seeing, like, knowing that you just won $100,000.
Yeah,
I would like them to know that it's not in my pocket as I'm walking through the parking lot.
Yeah. A poker friend of mine once ran out of money in Atlantic City and had to go to a not great part of Atlantic City. And there aren't that many, and not great for Atlantic City. So you can imagine, and had to go get $20,000. And like on the way out, he was basically like saying like, look, this is a traveler's check. I do not have cash. This is a traveler. I came here cause I have no money and this is not any kind of bearer instrument. So it's, yeah, no, I think you're fine. I can see why it didn't get a ton of laughs, but yeah. That's all okay. It reminds me a bit of when Phil Ivey was heads up with John Minette for a bracelet, or Minetti. And John's known for being a little bit of a crank or a salty character, and Phil Ivey is known for being Phil Ivey. And I think somebody said, like, yeah, I was probably the only person there rooting for John, so, like some other Commerce regular. It probably there were other people there who have longer histories at Lucky Chances or who are more of obvious gambler types than you are, who had more of the crowd sympathy. I doubt there was much you could have done to get a big laugh at that point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was more just whether like that was sufficiently, because this person was like, well, you know, these people were here and they were watching you all this time, and then you went and insulted them. And I was like, I don't know, it's not like they were like watching and cheering for me. I think to some extent I was sort of being rooted against because there were some people who were like well known to the crowd. Yeah. I mean, not the people who were like wishing me. There wasn't a lot of rooting going on, period. But I mean, like, it's not like people were there like supporting me per se. They were there for entertainment.
Yeah. I mean, if money were being added to the prize pool for poker players to be entertainers, also, then my advice would be different. But I think you're cool. I think you behaved very reasonably.
And I mean, I did actually have, so while I was waiting, I mean, it was like over an hour for getting all this paperwork done because they're doing it for everybody. And I guess they did mine last. Probably the tipping situation didn't help there. So just like while I was sitting around, this young woman approached me and was just sort of like started chatting with me, said congratulations, and just like immediately, you know, my radar is, well, just anytime a young woman approaches me, my radar goes up. But especially in this instance, my radar sort of went up. But we chatted for like an hour, and like nothing seemed, she didn't like have an aura of desperation to her, and she was like nice enough that I started to feel bad about it, but she did in fact ask me for money, but before the conversation was over.
I see.
And did not get it, but I felt validated because I seriously was like, oh, you're such an asshole for judging her. She was just being nice. She'd been watching you all this time, and now she's chatting with you, and you know, why are you assuming the worst? And but the worst was true.
Yeah.
Well, not the worst, but what I was assuming was true.
Yeah, that's not surprising. I assume you were civil and polite. Yeah, so yeah, once again, it's.
No, I mean, I could tell that she was embarrassed by it, and I tried to minimize that embarrassment for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was not going to give her money, even though she was going to pay me back next week.
I see. I thought maybe she was going to ask that you give her money in a different sort of transaction, but
no.
I see.
No, she just wanted a steak.
I see. Understood.
I only play a few dozen tournaments a year, so it's not really that surprising that I haven't had a big score, a truly big score, since 2011. But I understand some people might have been asking themselves, what's this guy doing working for a tournament poker edge? He's washed up. He hasn't had an edge since 2011. The game's passed him by. Well, I've still got it, people. If that's the reason you haven't signed up for Tournament Poker Edge, if you were concerned that I was some sort of washed-up former tournament player who doesn't know what he's doing in a tournament anymore, and you thought that was reflective of the site, go sign up now. Treat yourself. Give yourself an early Christmas or Hanukkah present. It's a gift that will keep on giving for years to come. Go sign up right now, tournamentpokeredge.com. You'll get plenty of tournament poker strategy from myself, including from some live tournaments, not necessarily this one, but some other live tournaments that I've played, some of my thoughts on live tournaments, as well as obviously plenty of online tournament content and videos from dozens of other top players as well. Tournamentpokeredge.com.
Nice job.
Thank you. Strategy hand. This one not coming from, this actually is from a cash game that I played the night before the tournament, and this hand got talked about. I've been asked nearly as often about this hand as I was about the tournament win. This is like the other big thing. Like the word of this hand got around the casino very quickly. So this is a 5-10-20 game. We're playing 5-10 with a mandatory straddle. $3,500 effective, at least with the main villain, but the other villain has at least $2,000. So the main villain is the player in the straddle. He is a professional, pretty good player overall. Gets a little over-aggressive, in my opinion, in what I consider kind of like obvious steal spots, but a lot of that is because most of the people he's playing against aren't really capable of doing anything about that. So, you know, he'll just like raise limpers with overly wide ranges and that sort of stuff. But I think he has enough respect for me as a player that he's not trying to just like run me over in really obvious ways. He's definitely capable of like higher level thinking, has some hand reading skill, etc. And I think he has a pretty decent understanding of deep stacked poker. Like he plays pretty often in this game and some other games in the Bay Area that have deep stacks. He plays a lot of PLO. Like I think he understands. He's not like a tournament player or a 100 big blind player who doesn't really know what he's doing with a 200 big blind stack in front of him. So the hijack, who is not the main villain here, but it might be a little bit relevant, he's a pretty weak player, pretty nitty, especially when it comes to preflop raising. He's nitty, so he does a lot of like limp calling, but if he's actually raising, that's significant even from late position. He plays very straightforwardly post-flop, will kind of let you know when he has big hands, doesn't like to fold them, but also doesn't like to get sucked out on. I imagine a lot of you know the type. So he opens from the hijack, this secondary villain opens from the hijack to $60. I have pocket sixes on the button and I call, and the professional in the straddle calls as well. This is uncontroversial so far to call with sixes.
Don't three bet, don't fold.
Perfect. So we see the flop, $190 in the pot, and the flop is 6-4-4 with two spades, so I have flopped a full house. They both check to me. I can see a case for betting here, although I chose to check in this case. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's good. I would probably be unbalanced in this spot. Like I would stab with a lot of straight draws and flush draws and sometimes with nothing. I think the check is a give up check from the raiser, at least sometimes, and I think
pretty much always.
Yeah,
he's, I mean, maybe he's gonna like check call with ace king or ace queen. I could see him maybe choosing not to bet those, but he doesn't have an overpair here ever.
Yeah, and I mean, if he check calls with ace king or ace queen, that's great because you win the pot. If you have jack 10 and he has ace king,
right.
Whether or not you hit a jack or a 10, you're probably going to win that pot, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So I think it's a good spot to bet. And even if you're a bit on balance, there's not that much the straddle can do from out of position. So I would bet some fours. I probably wouldn't bet sixes full. You've got the deck locked up a little bit too much. So I think that's fine. I would bet like sevens, eights, nines, tens, you know, some fours, then a whole bushel full of bluffs, and I would be happy with that.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because this is going to become significant later. I think you're right that this is a really good spot to stab if I have very little. So you mentioned even like Jack 10, which I think is fine. I think potential overcards to like a pocket pair that the straddle might check call me with is enough of a draw to bet. So I probably wouldn't bet here if I had like deuce three somehow. Yeah. But it's pretty hard not to have overcards to this board or not to have a straight draw of some sort. So like 5-3 is a good betting hand. I think 8-7 is a fine betting hand. 7-5, I guess maybe I would check like 9-8. But even that's like backdoor draw. I mean, it's hard for me to find a reason not to bet if I have nothing, just because the preflop raiser is going to lose the pot, whether he folds on the flop or not. He's going to lose the pot so often, and it's hard for the straddle to have much of anything and hard for him to play back at me. So it's a really good spot for me to bet if I have nothing. It's also a really good spot for me to make a sort of protection slash value bet with a lot of my marginal type hands. So I think that the check here is... It probably is a little unbalanced in terms of having value hands, and a lot of that is based on wanting to exploit the preflop raiser, who right now just has nothing. And so when I have a very strong hand that doesn't need protection, I would like to give him a chance to improve, and I think I'm not really giving up much against the straddle because he's not very likely to have anything anyway. So I don't really see much downside to being unbalanced here, but I do think you're right that it's an unbalanced check, and I think it's good that we're flagging that now because it'll become significant later.
Yeah, and I also think that one reason it's okay to be unbalanced is that there aren't many players who are disciplined enough to bluff here every time that they should, so it's going to be very hard for this check to be perceived as too unbalanced. Like, I'm sure people will suspect, at least some people will suspect, that you would bluff here a lot, but to be really confident that you're going to bluff here every single time, like, you're not going to let your mind wander, you're not going to order a drink, you're not going to decide that you don't feel like losing $100, etc., like, that you're really going to do it every time that you should, that's a very different thing. So I'm not sure it'll be perceived as unbalanced as it is.
Good. I think that's a good comment. So as it happens, I did check behind, and we see the turn, still $190 in the pot. I'm still holding pocket sixes, and the turn is an offsuit eight. So the board now 8-6-4-4 with two spades. Now the player in the straddle bets $100, so about half the pot. That's 100 into 190. The preflop raiser, who is in the hijack, folds, and the action is on me. What do you think here about raising versus calling?
I would raise because there's plenty of money behind, and because you have a really good hand, and because he can have stuff that he can call you with worse, and because he can be bluffing, and you can want to steal here sometimes if you happen not to have bluffed on the flop.
I'm with you on all of that up until that last point. So I think all those first things that you say are true. And obviously, like, there's a ton of money behind, and I have a huge hand, and I would like to start building a pot. And there's plenty of second best hands he could potentially have. I know I kind of cut you off before you made the full case for how I could be bluffing here, but I do kind of want to flag for people, and this was a concern of mine as soon as I raised. I do actually think it's pretty tough for me to be bluffing here, like, given how often I'm betting with nothing on the flop. And when I do have nothing on the flop, like, if I were to check nothing on the flop, it would be sort of weird for me to then... I mean, there's good reason for me to then raise it on the turn, but, like, a lot of the same mistakes that would have caused me to check it on the flop, like you said, not paying attention or you know, having checked out or for some reason being a little risk-averse right now, like, all of those things would probably also cause me to not raise the turn.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think that he's going to be betting here with some things that it's going to be hard to continue with. And although you will have taken a lot of the bottom of your range out of your range on the flop, I'm not sure that'll be the case all the time. And, you know, if I sort of teleported into your spot on the turn, I would want to put a little bit of pressure on this bet. It's just really easy for him to have ace seven or ace five or a hand like that. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. So if you did have, you know, Jack 10 or you even had like ace jack, or you know, ace ten that you just called with before the flop. Not that you would all the time. Then you decided not to bet that on the flop. Yeah, there are reasons to try to knock him off of a six, or to try to get, you know, protection or value from a seven or a hand like that. You know, I can see not wanting to call with that hand on the turn, and I can also see not wanting to fold it. So I could imagine throwing in a raise with that hand.
Now that I think about it, I could actually see if I had called with ace eight suited preflop, which I'm not sure I would. I could see myself making this play with that, yeah. Like not betting the flop because ace high is a pretty good hand, and then on the turn making kind of like a thin value slash protection raise. I don't know that I would call preflop with ace eight suited. I don't think I really would or should. And I think if I had a smaller eight like 7-8, I would want to bet the flop. Maybe 9-8 I can play this way, but I think with 9-8 you start to run into kicker issues if your raise gets called. So it's pretty tough for me to like find a medium strength hand. So my concern here is just that this raise I think looks extremely strong. Which might not be obvious to some people, and hopefully we're doing a reasonable job of explaining why, but I just think most of the air in my range disappears when I check the flop, as do a lot of the medium strength hands in my range, and I don't have a lot of incentive to raise the turn with medium strength hands either. So if I had something like pocket threes that I didn't bet the flop with, I wouldn't really want to raise with it, and even if I had like 9-8, I'm not sure it's a good raise. I don't know that I would get here with ace eight suited, so I just think it's like this isn't a spot where I'm going to end up raising very often, and when I do raise, I think I'm going to have a lot of really strong hands.
I agree. And I also think that this is why, you know, slow playing is less good than players think it is sometimes. I still think the flop check is correct, but it's not a free pass to sneakily put in hundreds of dollars with no consequence later. Like, this is a pretty you're absolutely right. You know, alarm bells really should be going off. A lot of your range will be strong here. I think that's uncontroversial and perhaps not obvious. So that's entirely right.
Yeah, I always think when people say, like, I check the flop because I want to look weak. I'm like, okay, checking the flop does look weak. But as soon as you put another dollar into the pot after checking the flop, you no longer look weak. Now you look even stronger than you were before. Because, like, obviously you're not going to, like, check call a weak hand, and you might not even check raise a weak hand. So, like, that image of weakness that you're projecting only lasts half a street. And then if you still have a lot of money behind, it's not necessarily, like, that's kind of a side on slow playing. So my concern anyway was that this was going to look quite strong to a good hand raider. And so I was particularly concerned when he now 3-bet to $1,040, leaving about a pot size bet behind. Assuming I call this, it'll be about a pot size bet behind. Yeah. So I was like, and again, that's like, this may just seem crazy to people that I'm sitting here holding like sixes full and feeling uncomfortable because I got 3-bet on the turn. But realistically, it's hard for me to imagine him like doing this with worse for value and also doing it as a bluff, especially for this sizing. Like, the hands he's trying to bluff me off of are not really hands where he needs to make it 1,040 rather than like 600.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's I wouldn't fold here. I'd be worried, but I wouldn't fold just because you're too high up in your range, and because I do think you can be bluffing sometimes. And I think if he has a 7 or ace 5, he's going to be tempted to pull the trigger pretty often. That said, it does sound funny because you have the third nuts. I think 4 betting here would be a pretty gross overplaying of your hand, and I think a re-raise is poor. So I would keep some of your funky flush draws, et cetera, in your range. And I also think it's possible for you to have a flush draw that you check on the flop sometimes.
Not spades, I can check.
Yeah. So I think I would try to keep some of that in your range if it's possible for you to call. I mean, I think it's going to be hard for you to get full value for your hand in an advantageous way. But I'm not ready to fold yet. But I certainly don't think you should put more action in right now. I would definitely just call here all the time.
There are probably also some people wondering, well, can he have 7-5 or can he have ace 4 or some like lower trips or a straight? I really don't think he's going to look at those as strong enough to make a huge 3-bet with. I mean, so here I'm talking about feeling kind of uncomfortable with a full house. For him to then be like, I want to shovel as much money into the pot as I can with a straight or a 4, when like it's pretty obvious, like once he 3-bets, for, you know, he's representing trips at least. So for me to like keep giving him action, I kind of have to be able to like beat Trips, at which point like 5-7 or ace 4 can't feel that good about it.
Yep, I agree.
And I don't have a lot of lower fours in my range that I'm going to like play a huge pot with. So I think this is a common thing that people will say to themselves when they have sixes full in this sort of spot is like, oh, I can imagine a worse hand that he might be overplaying. And I really encourage people to be sort of rigorous about whether your opponent would really play that hand this way, because there's definitely a strong inclination not to want to make big laydowns. I mean, it's always more fun to call and see the showdown, and at least you're not going to have that nagging feeling of like, well, what if I was wrong? But I think... Try to be rigorous about whether your opponent would really play a second best hand this way. And I realize some of your opponents actually would. Like, not everyone is as savvy as this particular player is, but I don't think a smart player is making this re-raise with a worse hand than mine, thinking he has the best hand.
I agree.
I did call, and we see the river, which is an offsuit jack. For the record, I do not think he ever has jacks in his range. It's pretty damn unlikely that I have jacks either, so this is basically a blank. I don't think this really influences... I think neither player is at all likely to be improved by this jack.
Yeah, I think 4-4-4-8. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's the craziest edge case. Like, if it's
I could have like ace jack of spades, but
well, I mean, I think in the never happens case, in the almost never happens case, where it's like 7-4 against 5-4. The 7 is now counterfeited, right? So if it came a deuce, then 4-4-4-8-7 would be 4-4-4-8-6. So I mean, but like, I actually think that's the most significant thing about this jack hitting, which is to say, it's a complete brick.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's some chance he could have like jack 4 suited if I'm wrong about him not overvaluing a 4 on the turn, but I really just, yeah, that's another like super edge case. Yeah. So, but we can basically ignore the fact that this is a jack.
And it's almost the same. I mean, there's a difference between 4s full and 4s with a jack kicker, but it's not that huge right here. So anyway, go ahead.
2270 on the river, and he ships it for approximately the size of the pot.
That really sucks. There was a time when I would have wanted to fold this hand. It could just be that of the last however many laydowns I've made, like I could just be snake bit that I've made too many big laydowns wrong recently. I think against a sufficiently good player, you're too far up in your range to fold. And by too far up, I mean you have the second best hand you could possibly have, or one of the four best combinations you could have. I think he can bluff sometimes. I could imagine you calling a bluff here sometimes. Like I think you're probably known as being capable of calling a bluff. I don't love it, but as described, I would not want. I could make some exploitive folds against this person, but probably not one that's this exploitive. I'm saying all the things that I sometimes criticize other people for saying, but I think against a player who is good enough to do like who is as described, and I'm not sure 100% of the time he'll realize that you can't have your bluffs or your marginal hands. I think it's possible. I do think it's possible for him to be bluffing. I do think sometimes he could be going nuts with a four. I'm not sure I can fold this hand. I would. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the results of this hand, I would call.
So I folded.
Okay.
And I am not convinced that's correct.
Yeah.
So I have a rule for myself that I try to follow, which is that basically I look for opportunities to make really big laydowns.
Sure. Me too, yeah.
Because I think that everyone kind of has a natural tendency to not make big laydowns. Like, I think basically every poker player in the world plays a few more pots than they should, and just like calls a little more often than they should, and doesn't fold quite as much as they should. I wrote an article called "The Calling Demon" that talks about this. But the idea is that there's some part of you that wants to call, and if I have a hand, that's particularly true when you have like an extremely strong hand and you're in a position to potentially win $4,000 or $5,000 pot. That would just be the profit on the pot, would be like $4,000. So there's a big part of your brain that's like excited about this, and it's like, we're about to win $4,000. And like, if somehow some like part of my subconscious or whatever is able to like punch through that and be like, hey, you're in trouble here, you're in trouble. I think there's a case for listening to that.
I agree.
I like to err on the side of listening to that. So that was a big part of the reason why I folded. I also thought that if it were a correct fold, I folded face up, which is something I very, very rarely do. Like, I can't remember the last time that I just like showed someone, especially in like a, you know, very significant spot like this in a big pot, you know, showed them what I had when I didn't have to. But I thought that if it were a correct fold, it would probably rattle him.
Yeah.
He didn't seem terribly rattled when he saw the cards. He did tell me later that it was a correct fold, though, which I don't really see any incentive for him to do that if it weren't. Like, I think he would have a lot more incentive to lie in the opposite direction and like try to convince me it was a bad fold when it wasn't. But he told me that he did actually have pocket eights. And the thing is that he has to, like, because I'm getting 2-1 on a call and there's only four combinations of hands that beat me, I really don't need him to have more than, you know, like 1.5 combinations of bluffs before this, or, you know, of any hand other than that can't beat me before this becomes a call. So, like, just the fact that he did have eights here doesn't by itself make this correct. But yeah. I did want to share that rule with people. I mean, for one thing, I thought this was an interesting hand, and I know that people at Lucky Chances are have been talking about it, and some of them listen to the show. So there's your explanation for how this happened. But I think that rule is a good one for people to have, that if you get like us, and I mean, I guess there are some people who take this the wrong direction, because I was criticizing tournament players for this. But if you find yourself with this like really bad feeling, I like to try to listen to it. And I'm not saying just like always go with your gut, because I think your gut can lead you wrong in a lot of ways. I just think this is one very specific spot where if I have like a gut feeling that this is bad, and that's strong enough to overcome the excitement of like having the third nuts, and I mean functionally the third nuts, and in a really big pot, I think there's reason to give credence to that.
Yeah, I think that's really good. I think a lot of the facts of this hand screen value, I think his turn sizing really looks like value.
Yeah, and that was one of the most suspicious things.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's good. I don't love calling, but I also think it's 2015, and like I read this great article by Andrew Brokus that said that, like, you know, sometimes you four bet and are prepared to six bet with a five in your hand, even when you don't know anything about the villain, and that's because, you know, you default to a sort of theoretically optimal play. And I think in this case, I'm quite eager to look for spots to make correct folds, but I'm not sure I'm eager enough to be so unbalanced as to fold this hand now. So I agree on the hunch, and I'm just a little bit different in my willingness to act on it absent a really specific laser read on this specific person in this spot, you know?
That's it. I agree with all that, and I'd feel more comfortable. Well, maybe not, because I think less good players are also more prone to be overvaluing hands. Yeah, like a big part of this was my conviction that he was not going to be overvaluing a hand, and I might not have that level of confidence with a less good player or someone who's a little more prone to tilt or anything else. I just didn't see it coming from him. But I your point is definitely taken, and I agree with all that.
Yeah, I think one really good way to overcome some of this is to like to get away from some of these biases is to adopt the third person perspective, which is generally an okay way of getting rid of bias. And you know, it's one thing to say I think you should call, but or I guess it's one thing to say at the table, you know, I think I should call. Another thing to say is, like, if I were on the rail, if I weren't playing this hand, and if I were to discover that I had sixes here, would I want to take $2,400 out of my pocket, go sit down and make the call with my own money, you know, getting the action for myself? And in this case, I think I actually, you know, I think I would. I think I would actually invest $2,400 that way in this spot. Yeah, I wouldn't love it. I wouldn't think the edge was big, but I'd be willing to do it, I think.
But I've gotten lots of unsolicited third and fourth and fifth and sixth person perspectives on this.
Yeah. But I do think it's useful, and I do think it's even a little bit harder to say, like, yes, I would put my own money in this spot than you know, to say, like, oh, I think you should have put your own $2,400 in there. So yeah, I think imagining that you're on the rail and not at the table is a useful technique. So what do the railbirds say? You shouldn't have folded?
Well, definitely everyone thought it was crazy in the moment. And then since the word has gotten around that he had pocket eights, you know, now a couple of people are more just like, oh, I wouldn't have been able to make that fold, or like sort of like as though it were correct, but I think a lot of people are just kind of being results oriented about they're like, well, he had eight, so I guess it was the right fold. And, you know, what an impressive thing. And I'm, as I said, I'm still not convinced that it was the right play. So the initial reaction was just amazement and sort of like, that seems terrible. And then after the results or alleged results started getting around, then I've gotten some more sort of like results oriented. I'm impressed by that kind of feedback, but I'm not putting a lot of confidence in that either, a lot of credibility in that either.
Yep. But I think it was, the fold was somewhere between defensible and good, and certainly the willingness to fold is excellent. So a nice answer.
Thank you.
And then you won the tournament, so you're obviously the best player in the room. So you have to.
That is funny too. How I've had people, you know, both from Lucky Chances and elsewhere, like ask me about coaching just after the tournament win, and I'm really reluctant to take people up on that if they like. I just think it's the wrong thing to be your impetus for. Yeah. And I think it's going to like, I think a lot of people who are approaching me immediately after that are going to have inflated expectations. Yep. About what's, you know, like that there must be some secret. And, you know, he obviously has the secret because we already thought he was like one of the better players at Lucky Chances. And then we see him win the big Lucky Chances tournament. Like he's got the secret and he's going to tell me the secret if I hire him as a coach. Yep. And that's not precisely how it works.
Definitely not. You've done a lot more coaching than I have, but I have done some. And I've got a lot of teaching background, and I know plenty about poker. I can help you with a lot of stuff, but I have nothing magical to pour in your ear.
Hey everyone, Andrew here with good news, bad news, and more good news. The first bit of good news is that the fundraising campaign that I was telling you guys about in the previous episode is off to a fantastic success. As of the time of this recording, it's been, I think, less than 72 hours since episode 150 was released, and you all have contributed more than $2,000, which I'm really blown away by. This has really exceeded my expectations of what we might accomplish here, and I certainly hope that there's more good things to come. You can count on more good things coming from my end. I've got the first of the free videos that I promised is up on my blog now. It's a recording of myself and Gareth Chantler reviewing his play in an ante-up tournament, and hopefully by the time this airs, I'll have at least one more video up. My promise was for every $500 contributed, there was going to be a free hour of video content available on the blog, so I'm working as quickly as I can to get those out there. I'm trying to have some interesting guests participating in those. So right now, there's a video. You can go to thinkingpoker.net. It should be one of the first posts on there. And you can find a link to a YouTube video completely free for you to watch it. If you've already donated, thank you very much. If you have not, feel free to watch the video. And if you find it helpful, then there's links in there. You can ship along whatever you think that video is worth to you. If you contribute at least $10, you will be entered into a drawing, I guess you could call it. I'm going to pick some random contributors of $10 or more, and I'm going to give away some cool prizes, including a free custom video, free month access to Tournament Poker Edge, free item from the Nickcast store, and whatever other cool stuff I can think of. So please keep the donations rolling in. Thank you so much to those of you who have donated already. Some of you have really blown me away with your generosity, and you keep impressing me. I will keep impressing you with as much good free stuff as I can bring to you. The bad news is we don't actually have a guest for this episode, so this is just about the end of the show. The good news is we do have an interview with Neil Blumenthal lined up for next week. So as we were talking about earlier in this episode, we were eager to talk to Neil. We ended up having a very good follow-up interview with him. We're not going to be able to get it to air in time for this particular episode, but we will be around for episode 152, which will be coming out on Monday the 15th, I believe. That Monday. And so a great follow-up interview with Neil Blumenthal. We'll talk about his Blumenfeld. We'll talk about his preparation for the final table, how he feels like it went, how it's changed his life, all that sort of stuff. Neil's just a great guy. It's a great interview. So something to look forward to. That's your last bit of good news. Thank you for listening, and be sure to check out that free video over at thinkingpoker.net. Take care, everybody.
tapping on my window pane. Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.